said he felt sorry for her, because she was no bigger than a minute, just as pregnant as the old woman who lived in a shoe and traveling with a young desperado bound for a bad end. "Did she try to stop him?" the reporter asked. "Try to talk him out of it?" "No," the farmer said, "just stood with her back turned, like she thought that if she didn't see it, it wasn't happening." The farmer's old rattletrap Rio was found abandoned near the McCook train depot with a note on the seat. "Here's your car back. We will send the money we stole when we can. We only took from you because we were in a scrape. Very truly yours, the Sweetheart Bandits." Whose idea was that name? Shannon's, probably. The note was in her handwriting. They only used it because they didn't want to give their names, but of such things, legends are made. A day or two later, there was a holdup in the tiny frontier bank of Arapahoe, Colorado. The thief, wearing a flat cap, yanked low, and a bandana, yanked high, was alone. He got less than $100 and drove off in a Hupmobile that had been reported stolen in McCook. The next day, in the First Bank of Cheyenne Wells, which was the only bank of Cheyenne Wells, the young man was joined by a young woman. She disguised her face with a bandana of her own, but it was impossible to disguise her pregnant state. They made off with $400 and drove out of town at high speed, headed west. A roadblock was set up on the road to Denver, but Henry played it smart and stayed lucky. They turned south not long after leaving Cheyenne Wells, picking their way along dirt roads and cattle tracks. A week later, a young couple calling themselves Harry and Susan Freeman boarded the train for San Francisco in Colorado Springs. Why they suddenly got off in Grand Junction, I don't know, and Arlette didn't say. Saw something that put their wind up, I suppose. All I know is that they robbed a bank there and another in Ogden, Utah. Their version of saving up money for their new life, maybe. And in Ogden, when a man tried to stop Henry outside the bank, Henry shot him in the chest. The man grappled with Henry anyway, and Shannon pushed him down the granite steps. They got away. The man Henry shot died in the hospital 2 days later. The Sweetheart Bandits had become murderers. In Utah, convicted murderers got the rope. By then it was near Thanksgiving, although which side of it, I don't know. The police west of the Rockies had their descriptions and were on the lookout. I had been bitten by the rat hiding in the closet, I think, or was about to be. Arlette told me they were dead, but they weren't. Not when she and her royal court came to visit me, that was. She either lied or prophesied. To me, they are both the same. Their next-to-last stop was Deeth, Nevada. It was a bitterly cold day in late November or early December, the sky white and beginning to spit snow. They only wanted eggs and coffee at the town's only diner, but their luck was almost all gone. The counterman was from Elkhorn, Nebraska, and although he hadn't been home in years, his mother still faithfully sent him issues of the World Herald in large bundles. He had received just such a bundle a few days before, and he recognized the Omaha Sweetheart Bandit sitting in one of the booths. Instead of ringing the police or pit security at the nearby copper mine, which would have been quicker and more efficient, he decided to make a citizen's arrest. He took a rusty old cowboy pistol from under the counter, pointed it at them, and told them, in the finest Western tradition, to throw up their hands. Henry did no such thing. He slid out of the booth and walked toward the fellow, saying, "Don't do that, my friend. We mean you no harm. We'll just pay up and go." The counterman pulled the trigger, and the old pistol misfired. Henry took it out of his hand, broke it, looked at the cylinder, and laughed. "Good news," he told Shannon. "These bullets have been in here so long they're green." He put $2 on the counter for their food and then made a terrible mistake. To this day, I believe things would have ended badly for them, no matter what. Yet still, I wish I could call to him across the years. Don't put that gun down still loaded. Don't do that, son. Green or not, put those bullets in your pocket. But only the dead can call across time. I know that now, and from personal experience. As they were leaving, "Hand in hand," Arlette whispered in my burning ear. The counterman snatched that old horse pistol off the counter, held it in both hands, and pulled the trigger again. This time it fired, and although he probably thought he was aiming at Henry, the bullet struck Shannon Cottery in the lower back. She screamed and stumbled forward out the door into the blowing snow. Henry caught her before she could fall and helped her into their last stolen car, another Ford. The counterman tried to shoot him through the window, and that time the old gun blew up in his hands. A piece of metal took out his left eye. I have never been sorry. I am not as forgiving as Charles Greiner. Seriously wounded, perhaps dying already, Shannon went into labor as Henry drove through thickening snow toward Elko, 30 miles to the southwest, perhaps thinking he might find a doctor there. I don't know if there was a doctor or not, but there was certainly a police station, and the counterman rang it with the remains of his eyeball still drying on his cheek. 2 local cops and 4 members of the Nevada State Patrol were waiting for Henry and Shannon at the edge of town, but Henry and Shannon never saw them. It's 30 miles between Deeth and Elko, and Henry made only 28 of them. Just inside the town limits, but still well beyond the edge of the village, the last of Henry's luck let go. With Shannon screaming and holding her belly as she bled all over the seat, he must have been driving fast, too fast. Or maybe he just hit a pothole in the road. However it was, the Ford skidded into the ditch and stalled. There they sat, in that high desert emptiness, while a strengthening wind blew snow all around them. And what was Henry thinking? That what he and I had done in Nebraska had led him and the girl he loved to that place in Nevada. Arlette didn't tell me that, but she didn't have to. I knew. He spied the ghost of a building through the thickening snow and got Shannon out of the car. She managed a few steps into the wind, then could manage no more. The girl who could do trigonometry and might have been the first female graduate of the normal school in Omaha laid her head on her young man's shoulder and said, "I can't go any farther, honey. Put me on the ground." "What about the baby?" he asked her. "The baby is dead, and I want to die too," she said. "I can't stand the pain. It's terrible. I love you, honey, but put me on the ground." He carried her to that ghost of a building instead, which turned out to be a line shack not much different from the shanty near Boystown, the one with the faded bottle of Royal Crown Cola painted on the side. There was a stove, but no wood. He went out and scrounged a few pieces of scrap lumber before the snow could cover them, and when he went back inside, Shannon was unconscious. Henry lit the stove, then put her head on his lap. Shannon Cottery was dead before the little fire he'd made burned down to embers. And then there was only Henry, sitting on a mean line shack cot where a dozen dirty cowboys had lain themselves down before him, drunk more often than sober. He sat there and stroked Shannon's hair while the wind shrieked outside and the shack's tin roof shivered. All these things Arlette told me on a day when those 2 doomed children were still alive. All these things she told me while the rats crawled around me and her stink filled my nose and my infected swollen hand ached like fire. I begged her to kill me, to open my throat as I'd open hers, and she wouldn't. That was her revenge. It might have been 2 days later when my visitor arrived at the farm, or even 3, but I don't think so. I think it was only one. I don't believe I could have lasted 2 or 3 more days without help. I had stopped eating and almost stopped drinking. Still, I managed to get out of bed and stagger to the door when the hammering on it commenced. Part of me thought it might be Henry, because part of me still dared hope that Arlette's visit had been a delusion hatched in delirium, and even if it had been real, that she had lied. It was Sheriff Jones. My knees loosened when I saw him, and I pitched forward. If he hadn't caught me, I would have gone tumbling out onto the porch. I tried to tell him about Henry and Shannon, that Shannon was going to be shot, that they were going to end up in a line shack on the outskirts of Elko, that he, Sheriff Jones, had to call somebody and stop it before it happened. All that came out was a garble, but he caught the names. "He's run off with her all right," Jones said. "But if Harl came down and told you that, why'd he leave you like this? What bit you?" "Rat," I managed. He got an arm around me and half carried me down the porch steps and toward his car. George the Rooster was lying frozen to the ground beside the woodpile, and the cows were lowing. When had I last fed them? I couldn't remember.
"Sheriff, you have to—"
But he cut me off. He thought I was raving, and why not? He could feel the fever baking off me and see it glowing in my face. It must have been like carrying an oven.
"You need to save your strength, and you need to be grateful to Arlette, because I never would have come out here if not for her."
"Dead?" I managed.
"Yes, she's dead all right."
So then I told him I'd killed her, and oh, the relief. A plugged pipe inside my head had magically opened, and the infected ghost which had been trapped in there was finally gone. He slung me into his car like a bag of meal.
"We'll talk about Arlette, but right now I'm taking you to Angels of Mercy, and I'll thank you not to upchuck in my car."
As he drove out of the dooryard, leaving the dead rooster and lowing cows behind, and the rats, don't forget them, I tried to tell him again that it might not be too late for Henry and Shannon, that it still might be possible to save them. I heard myself saying, "These are things that may be," as if I were the spirit of Christmas yet to come in the Dickens story. Then I passed out. When I woke up, it was the 2nd of December, and the Western newspapers were reporting, "Sweetheart bandits elude Elko police, escape again." They hadn't. But no one knew that yet, except Arlette, of course, and me. The doctor thought the gangrene hadn't advanced up my forearm and gambled my life by amputating only my left hand. That was a gamble he won. 5 days after being carried into Hemmingford City's Angels of Mercy Hospital by Sheriff Jones, I lay wan and ghostly in a hospital bed, 25 pounds lighter and minus my left hand, but alive. Jones came to see me, his face grave. I waited for him to tell me he was arresting me for the murder of my wife, and then handcuffed my remaining hand to the hospital bedpost. But that never happened. Instead, he told me how sorry he was for my loss. My loss? What did that idiot know about loss? Why am I sitting in this mean hotel room, but not alone, instead of lying in a murderer's grave? I'll tell you in 2 words. My mother. Like Sheriff Jones, she had a habit of peppering her conversation with rhetorical questions. With him, it was a conversational device he'd picked up during a lifetime in law enforcement. He asked his silly little questions, then observed the person he was talking to for any guilty reaction, a wince, a frown, a small shift of the eyes. With my mother, it was only a habit of speech she had picked up from her own mother, who was English, and passed on to me. I've lost any faint British accent I might once have had, but never lost my mother's way of turning statements into questions. "You'd better come in now, hadn't you?" she'd say. Or, "Your father forgot his lunch again. You'll have to take it to him, won't you?" Even observations about the weather came couched as questions. "Another rainy day, isn't it?" Although I was feverish and very ill when Sheriff Jones came to the door on that late November day, I wasn't delirious. I remember our conversation clearly, the way a man or woman may remember images from a particularly vivid nightmare.
"You need to be grateful to Arlette, because I never would have come out here if not for her," he said.
"Dead," I replied.
"Sheriff Jones?"
"She's dead, all right."
And then, speaking as I had learned to speak at my mother's knee,
"I killed her, didn't I?"
Sheriff Jones took my mother's rhetorical device, and his own, don't forget, as a real question. Years later, it was in the factory where I found work after I lost the farm, I heard a foreman berating a clerk for sending an order to Des Moines instead of Davenport, before the clerk had gotten the shipping form from the front office.
"But we always send the Wednesday orders to Des Moines," the soon-to-be-fired clerk protested. "I simply assumed."
"Assume makes an ass out of you and me," the foreman replied. An old saying, I suppose, but that was the first time I heard it. And is it any wonder that I thought of Sheriff Frank Jones when I did? My mother's habit of turning statements into questions saved me from the electric chair. I was never tried by a jury for the murder of my wife. Until now, that is. They're here with me, a lot more than 12, lined up along the baseboard all the way around the room, watching me with their oily eyes. If a maid came in with fresh sheets and saw those furry jurors, she would run, shrieking. But no maid will come. I hung the Do Not Disturb sign on the door 2 days ago, and it's been there ever since. I haven't been out. I could order food sent up from the restaurant down the street, I suppose, but I suspect food would set them off. I'm not hungry, anyway, so it's no great sacrifice. They have been patient so far, my jurors, but I suspect they won't be for much longer. Like any jury, they're anxious for the testimony to be done so they can render a verdict, receive their token fee, in this case to be paid in flesh, and go home to their families. So I must finish. It won't take long. The hard work is done. What Sheriff Jones said when he sat down beside my hospital bed was,
"You saw it in my eyes, I guess. Isn't that right?"
I was still a very sick man, but enough recovered to be cautious.
"Saw what, Sheriff?" "What I'd come to tell you. You don't remember, do you? Well, I'm not surprised. You were one sick American, Wilf. I was pretty sure you were going to die, and I thought you might do it before I got you back to town. I guess God's not done with you yet, is he?"
Something wasn't done with me, but I doubted if it was God. "Was it Henry? Did you come out to tell me something about Henry?"
"No," he said. "It was Arlette I came about. It's bad news. The worst. But you can't blame yourself. It's not like you beat her out of the house with a stick."
He leaned forward.
"You might have got the idea that I don't like you, Wilf, but that's not true. There's some in these parts who don't, and we know who they are, don't we? But don't put me in with them just because I have to take their interests into account. You've irritated me a time or two, and I believe that you'd still be friends with Harl Cottery if you'd kept your boy on a tighter rein, but I've always respected you."
I doubted it, but kept my lip buttoned.
"As for what happened to Arlette, I'll say it again, because it bears repeating. You can't blame yourself."
I couldn't? I thought that was an odd conclusion to draw, even for a lawman who would never be confused with Sherlock Holmes.
"Henry's in trouble, if some of the reports I'm getting are true," he said heavily. "And he's dragged Shan Cottery into the hot water with him. They'll likely boil in it. That's enough for you to handle without claiming responsibility for your wife's death as well. You don't have to. Just tell me, I said. 2 days previous to his visit, perhaps the day the rat bit me, perhaps not, but around that time, a farmer, headed into Limebiska with the last of his produce, had spied a trio of coy dogs fighting over something about 20 yards north of the road. He might have gone on if he hadn't also spied a scuffed lady's patent leather shoe and a pair of pink step-ins lying in the ditch. He stopped, fired his rifle to scare off the coys, and advanced into the field to inspect their prize. What he found was a woman's skeleton with the rags of a dress and a few bits of flesh still hanging from it. What remained of her hair was a listless brown, the color to which Arlette's rich auburn might have gone after months out in the elements.
Two of the back teeth were gone, Jones said. Was Arlette missing a couple of back teeth?
Yes, I lied. Lost them from a gum infection.
When I came out that day just after she ran off, your boy said she took her good jewelry.
Yes. The jewelry that was now in the well.
When I asked if she could have laid her hands on any money, you mentioned $200. Isn't that right?
Ah, yes. The fictional money Arlette had supposedly taken from my dresser.
That's right.
He was nodding.
Well, there you go. There you go. Some jewelry and some money. That explains everything, wouldn't you say?
I don't see...
Because you're not looking at it from a lawman's point of view. She was robbed on the road, that's all. Some bad egg spied a woman hitchhiking between Hemmingford and Limebiska, picked her up, killed her, robbed her of her money and her jewelry, then carried her body far enough into the nearest field so it couldn't be seen from the road.
From his long face, I could see he was thinking she had probably been raped as well as robbed, and that it was probably a good thing that there wasn't enough of her left to tell for sure.
That's probably it, then, I said, and somehow I was able to keep a straight face until he was gone.
Then I turned over, and although I thumped my stump in doing so, I began to laugh. I buried my face in my pillow, but not even that would stifle the sound. When the nurse, an ugly old battle axe, came in and saw the tears streaking my face, she assumed, which makes an ass out of you and me, that I had been crying. She softened, a thing I would have thought impossible, and gave me an extra morphine pill. I was, after all, the grieving husband and bereft father. I deserved comfort. And do you know why I was laughing? Was it Jones's well-meaning stupidity? The fortuitous appearance of a dead female hobo who might have been killed by her male traveling companion while they were drunk? It was, both of those things, but mostly... it was the shoe. The farmer had only stopped to investigate what the coy dogs were fighting over because he'd seen a lady's patent leather shoe in the ditch. But when Sheriff Jones had asked about footwear that day at the house, the previous summer, I'd told him Arlette's canvas shoes were the ones that were gone. The idiot had forgotten. And he never remembered. When I got back to the farm, almost all my livestock was dead. The only survivor was Achilloas, who looked at me with reproachful, starveling eyes and lowed plaintively. I fed her as lovingly as you might feed a pet, and really, that was all she was. What else would you call an animal that can no longer contribute to a family's livelihood? There was a time when Harlan, assisted by his wife, would have taken care of my place while I was in the hospital. It's how we neighbored out in the middle. But even after the mournful blat of my dying cows started drifting across the fields to him while he sat down to his supper, he stayed away. If I'd been in his place, I might have done the same. In Harl Cottery's view and the world's, my son hadn't been content just to ruin his daughter. He'd followed her to what should have been a place of refuge,
stolen her away and forced her into a life of crime. How that sweetheart bandit stuff must have eaten into her father, like acid. The following week, around the time the Christmas decorations were going up in farmhouses and along Main Street in Hemingford home, Sheriff Jones came out to the farm again. One look at his face told me what his news was, and I began to shake my head. No, no more. I won't have it. I can't have it. Go away. I went back in the house and tried to bar the door against him, but I was both weak and one-handed, and he forced his way in easily enough.
Take hold, Wilf, he said. You'll get through this, as if he knew what he was talking about.
He looked in the cabinet with a decorative ceramic beer stein on top of it, found my sadly depleted bottle of whiskey, poured the last finger into the stein, and handed it to me.
Doctor wouldn't approve, he said, but he's not here, and you're going to need it.
The sweetheart bandits had been discovered in their final hideout. Shannon, dead of the counterman's bullet. Henry, of one he'd put into his own brain. The bodies had been taken to the Elko mortuary, pending instructions. Harlan Cuttery would see to his daughter, but would have nothing to do with my son. Of course not. I did that myself. Henry arrived in Hemingford by train on the 18th of December, and I was at the depot, along with a black funeral hack from Castings Brothers. My picture was taken repeatedly. I was asked questions, which I didn't even try to answer. The headlines in both the World Herald and the much humbler Hemingford Weekly featured the phrase, "Grieving Father." If the reporters had seen me at the funeral home, however, when the cheap pine box was opened, they would have seen real grief. They could have featured the phrase, "Screaming Father." The bullet my son fired into his temple as he sat with Shannon's head on his lap had mushroomed as it crossed his brain and taken out a large chunk of his skull on the left side. But that wasn't the worst. His eyes were gone. His lower lip was chewed away so that his teeth jutted in a grim grin. All that remained of his nose was a red stub. Before some cop or sheriff's deputy had discovered the bodies, the rats had made a merry meal of my son and his dear love. "Fix him up," I told Herbert Castings when I could talk rationally again.
"Mr. James, sir, the damage is..."
"I see what the damage is!
Fix him up and get him out of that shitting box. Put him in the finest coffin you have. I don't care what it costs. I have money."
I bent and kissed his torn cheek. No father should have to kiss his son for the last time. But if any father ever deserved such a fate, it was I. Shannon and Henry were both buried out of the Hemingford Glory of God Methodist Church. Shannon on the 22nd and Henry on Christmas Eve. The church was full for Shannon, and the weeping was almost loud enough to raise the roof. I know, because I was there at least for a little while. I stood in the back, unnoticed, then slunk out halfway through Reverend Thursby's eulogy. Reverend Thursby also presided at Henry's funeral, but I hardly need to tell you that the attendance was much smaller. Thursby saw only one, but there was another. Arlette was there, too, sitting next to me. Unseen and smiling, whispering in my ear.
"Do you like how things have turned out, Wilf? Was it worth it?"
Adding in the funeral cost, the burial expenses, the mortuary expenses, and the cost of shipping the body home, the disposal of my son's earthly remains cost just over $300. I paid out of the mortgage money. What else did I have? When the funeral was finished, I went home to an empty house. But first I bought a fresh bottle of whiskey. 1922 had one more trick left in its bag. The day after Christmas, a huge blizzard roared out of the Rockies, socking us with a foot of snow. and gale force winds. As dark came down, the snow turned first to sleet, and then to driving rain. Around midnight, as I sat in the darkened parlor, doctoring my bellowing stump with little sips of whiskey, a grinding, rending sound came from the back of the house. It was the roof coming down on that side, the part I'd taken out the mortgage, at least in part, to fix. I toasted it with my glass, then had another sip. When the cold wind began to blow in around my shoulders, I took my coat from its hook in the mudroom, put it on, then sat back down, and drank a little more whiskey. At some point I dozed. Another of those grinding crashes woke me around 3 o'clock. This time it was the front half of the barn that had collapsed. Akaloa survived yet again, and the next night I took her into the house with me. Why, you might ask me, and my answer would be, why not? Just why the hell not? We were the survivors. We were the survivors. On Christmas morning, which I spent sipping whiskey in my cold sitting room with my surviving cow for company, I counted what was left of the mortgage money and realized it would not begin to cover the damage done by the storm. I didn't much care, because I had lost my taste for the farming life. But the thought of the Farrington Company putting up a hog butchery and polluting the stream still made me grind my teeth in rage, especially after the high cost I had paid for keeping those triple goddamned 100 acres out of the company's hands. It suddenly struck home to me that, with Arlette officially dead instead of missing, those acres were mine. So 2 days later, I swallowed my pride and went to see Harlan Cottery. The man who answered my knock had fared better than I, but that year's shocks had taken their toll just the same. He had lost weight, he had lost hair, and his shirt was wrinkled, although not as wrinkled as his face, and the shirt at least would iron out. He looked 65 instead of 45. "Don't hit me," I said when I saw him ball his fists. "Hear me out." "I wouldn't hit a man with only one hand," he said, "but I'll thank you to keep it short. And we'll have to talk out here on the stoop, because you are never going to set foot inside my house again." "That's fine," I said. I had lost weight myself, plenty, and I was shivering, but the cold air felt good on my stump and on the invisible hand that still seemed to exist below it. "I want to sell you 100 acres of good land, Harl. The 100 Arlette was so determined to sell to the Farrington Company." He smiled at that, and his eyes sparkled in their new deep hollows. "Fallen on hard times, haven't you? Half your house and half your barn caved in. Hermy Gordon says you've got a cow living in there with you." Hermy Gordon was the rural route mailman and a notorious gossip. I named a price so low that Harl's mouth fell open and his eyebrows shot up. It was then that I noticed a smell wafting out of a neat and well-appointed Cottery farmhouse that seemed entirely alien to that place. Burnt fried food. Sally Cottery was apparently not doing the cooking. Once I might have been interested in such a thing, but that time had passed. All I cared about right then was getting shed of the 100 acres. It only seemed right to sell them cheap, since they had cost me so dear. "That's pennies on the dollar," he said. Then, with evident satisfaction, "Arlette would roll in her grave." "She's done more than just roll in it," I thought.
"What are you smiling about, Wilf?"
"Nothing. Except for one thing. I don't care about that land anymore. The one thing I do care about is keeping that goddamned Farrington slaughter mill off it."
"Even if you lose your own place?"
He nodded as if I'd asked a question.
"I know about the mortgage you took out. No secrets in a small town."
"Even if I do," I agreed.
Take the offer, Harl. You'd be crazy not to. That stream they'll be filling up with blood and hair and hog intestines, that's your stream, too.
No,
he said. I stared at him, too surprised to say anything. But again, he nodded, as if I'd asked a question.
You think you know what you've done to me, but you don't know all of it. Sally's left me. She's gone to stay with her folks down McCook. She says she may be back. Says she'll think things over, but I don't think she will be. So that puts you and me in the same old broke wagon, doesn't it?
We're two men who started the year with wives and are ending it without them. We're two men who started the year with living children and are ending it with dead ones. The only difference I can see is that I didn't lose half my house and most of my barn in a storm. He thought about it.
And I've still got both hands. There's that, I suppose. When it comes to pulling my Peter, should I ever feel the urge to, I'd have a choice of which one to use.
What? Why would she?
Oh, use your head.
She blames me, as well as you, for Shannon's death. She said that if I hadn't gotten on my high horse and sent Shan away, she'd still be alive and living with Henry at your farm, just down the road, instead of lying frozen in a box underground. She says she'd have a grandchild. She called me a self-righteous fool, and she's right.
I reached for him with my remaining hand. He slapped it away. Don't touch me, Wilf. A single warning on that is all you get.
I put my hand back at my side. One thing I know for sure, he said. If I took you up on that offer, tasty as it is, I'd regret it, because that land is cursed. We may not agree on everything, but I bet we would on that. If you want to sell it to the bank. You'll get your mortgage paper back and some cash besides.
They'd just turn around and sell it to Farrington.
Tough titty, said the kitty,
was his final word on it as he closed the door in my face. On the last day of the year, I drove to Hemmingford home and saw Mr. Stoppenhauser at the bank. I told him that I'd decided I could no longer live on the farm. I told him I would like to sell Arlette's acreage to the bank and use the balance of the proceeds to retire the mortgage. Like Harlan Cottery? He said no. For a moment or two, I just sat in the chair facing his desk, not able to believe what I had heard. Why not? That's good land. He told me that he worked for a bank, and a bank was not a real estate agency. He addressed me as Mr. James. My days of being Wilf in that office were over.
That's just...
Ridiculous was the word that came to mind, but I didn't want to risk offending him if there was even a chance he might change his mind. Once I had made the decision to sell the land and the cow, I would have to find a buyer for Akaloas, too, possibly a stranger with a bag of magic beans to trade. The idea had taken hold of me with the force of an obsession. So I kept my voice low and spoke calmly. That's not exactly true, Mr. Stoppenhauser. The bank bought the ride-out place last summer when it came up for auction. The Triple M, as well.
Those were different situations.
We hold a mortgage on your original 80, and we're content with that. What you do with that 100 acres of pasturage is of no interest to us.
Who's been in to see you? I asked, then realized I didn't have to.
It was Lester, wasn't it? Cole Farrington's dog's body.
I have no idea what you're talking about, Stoppenhauser said, but I saw the flicker in his eyes.
I think your grief and your injury have temporarily damaged your ability to think clearly.
Oh, no, I said, and began to laugh.
It was a dangerously unbalanced sound, even to my own ears.
I've never thought more clearly in my life, sir. He came to see you, him or another.
I'm sure Cole Farrington can afford to retain all the shysters he wants. And you made a deal. You colluded. I was laughing harder than ever.
Mr. James, I'm afraid I'll have to ask you to leave.
Maybe you had it all planned out beforehand, I said. Maybe that's why you were so anxious to talk me into the goddamn mortgage in the first place. Or maybe when Lester heard about my son, he saw a golden opportunity to take advantage of my misfortune and came running to you. Maybe he sat right in this chair and said, "This is going to work out for both of us, Stoppy. You get the farm, my client gets the land by the creek, and Wilf James could go to hell." Isn't that pretty much how it went? He had pushed a button on his desk, and now the door opened. It was just a little bank, too small to employ a security guard, but the teller who leaned in was a beefy lad, one of the Rohrbacher family, from the look of him. I'd gone to school with his father, and Henry would have gone with his younger sister, Mandy.
"Is there a problem, Mr. Stoppenhauser?" he asked. "Not if Mr. James leaves now," he said. "Won't you see him out, Kevin?"
Kevin came in, and when I was slow to rise, he clamped a hand just above my left elbow. He was dressed like a banker, right down to the suspenders and the bow tie, but it was a farmer's hand, hard and calloused. My still-healing stump gave a warning throb.
"Come along, sir," he said.
"Don't pull me," I said. "It hurts where my hand used to be."
"Then come along."
"I went to school with your father. He sat beside me and used to cheat off my paper during spring testing week."
He pulled me out of the chair where I had once been addressed as Wilf.
Good old Wilf, who would be a fool not to take out a mortgage.
The chair almost fell over.
"Happy New Year, Mr. James," Stoppenhauser said. "And to you, you cousining fuck," I replied.
Seeing the shocked expression on his face may have been the last good thing to happen to me in my life. I have sat here for 5 minutes, chewing on the end of my pen and trying to think of one sense. A good book? A good meal? A pleasant afternoon in the park? And I can't. Kevin Rohrbacher accompanied me across the lobby. I suppose that is the correct verb. It wasn't quite dragging. The floor was marble and our footfalls echoed. The walls were dark oak. At the high teller's windows, two women served a little group of year-end customers. One of the tellers was young and one was old, but their bug-eyed expressions were identical. Yet it wasn't their horrified, almost prurient interest that took my own eye. It was captivated by something else entirely. A burled oak rail 3 inches wide ran above the teller's windows, and scurrying busily along it.
"Where that rat?"
I cried and pointed. The young teller voiced a little scream, looked up, then exchanged a glance with her older counterpart. There was no rat, only the passing shadow of the ceiling fan, and now everyone was looking at me.
"Stare all you want," I told them. "Look your fill. Look until your goddamned eyes fall out."
Then I was in the street and puffing out cold winter air that looked like cigarette smoke.
"Don't come back unless you have business to do," Kevin said. "And unless you can keep a civil tongue."
Your father was the biggest goddamn cheater I ever went to school with, I told him. I wanted him to hit me. But he only went back inside and left me alone on the sidewalk, standing in front of my saggy old truck. And that was how Wilfred Leland James spent his visit to town on the last day of 1922. When I got home, Akalois was no longer in the house. She was in the yard, lying on her side and puffing her own clouds of white vapor. I could see the snow scuffs where she'd gone galloping off the porch and the bigger one where she'd landed badly and broken both front legs. Not even a blameless cow could survive around me, it seemed. I went into the mudroom to get my gun. then into the house, wanting to see, if I could, what had frightened her so badly that she'd left her new shelter at a full gallop. It was rats, of course. Three of them, sitting on Arlette's treasured sideboard, looking at me with their black and solemn eyes. "Go back and tell her to leave me alone," I told them. "Tell her she's done damage enough. For God's sake, tell her to let me be." They only sat looking at me, with their tails curled around their plump, black-gray bodies. So I lifted my varmint rifle and shot the one in the middle. The bullet tore it apart and splattered its leavings all over the wallpaper Arlette had picked out with such care 9 or 10 years before, when Henry was still just a little one, and things among the three of us were fine. The other two fled, back to their secret way underground, I have no doubt. Back to their rotting queen. What they left behind on my dead wife's sideboard were little piles of rat shit and 3 or 4 bits of the burlap sack Henry fetched from the barn on that early summer night in 1922. The rats had come to kill my last cow and bring me little pieces of Arlette's snood. I went outside and patted Akaloas on the head. She stretched her neck up and lowed plaintively. "Make it stop. You're the master. You're the god of my world. So make it stop." I did. Happy New Year. That was the end of 1922, and that is the end of my story. All the rest is epilogue. The emissaries crowded around this room. How the manager of this fine old hotel would scream if he saw them. "We'll not have to wait much longer to render their verdict. She is the judge, they are the jury, but I'll be my own executioner." I lost the farm, of course. Nobody, including the Farrington Company, would buy those 100 acres until the home place was gone. And when the hog butchers finally swooped in, I was forced to sell at an insanely low price. Lester's plan worked perfectly. I'm sure it was his, and I'm sure he got a bonus. Oh, well, I would have lost my little toehold in Hemingford County even if I'd had financial resources to fall back on. And there is a perverse sort of comfort in that. They say this depression we are in started on Black Friday of last year, but people in states like Kansas, Iowa, and Nebraska know it started in 1923, when the crops that survived the terrible storms that spring were killed in the drought that followed, a drought that lasted for 2 years. The few crops that did find their way to the big city markets and the small city agricultural exchanges brought a beggar's price. Harlan Cottery hung on until 1925 or so, and then the bank took his farm. I happened on that news while perusing the bank sales items in the World Herald. By 1925, such items sometimes took up whole pages in the newspaper. The small farms had begun to go, and I believe that in 100 years, maybe only 75, they'll all be gone. Come 2030, if there is such a year, all Nebraska west of Omaha will be one big farm. Probably it'll be owned by the Farrington Company, and those unfortunate enough to live on that land will pass their existence under dirty yellow skies and wear gas masks to keep from choking on the stench of dead hogs, and every stream will run red with the blood of slaughter. Come 2030, only the rats will be happy. "That's pennies on the dollar," Harlan said on the day I offered to sell him Arlette's land, and eventually I was forced to sell to Cole Farrington for even fewer on the dollar. Andrew Lester, attorney at law, brought the papers to the Hemingford City rooming house where I was then living, and he smiled as I signed them. Of course he did. The big boys always win. I was a fool to think it could ever be any different. I was a fool, and everyone I ever loved paid the price. I sometimes wonder if Sally Cottery ever came back to Harlan, or if he went to her in McCook after he lost the farm. I don't know. But I think Shannon's death probably ended that previously happy marriage. Poison spreads like ink in water. Meanwhile, the rats have begun to move in from the baseboards of this room. What was a square has become a closing circle. They know that this is just the after, and nothing that comes after an irrevocable act matters much. Yet I will finish, and they won't have me while I'm alive. The final small victory will be mine. My old brown jacket is hung on the back of the chair I'm sitting in. The pistol is in the pocket. When I've finished the last few pages of this confession, I'll use it. They say suicides and murderers go to hell. If so, I will know my way around, because I've been there for the last 8 years. I went to Omaha, and if it is indeed a city of fools, as I used to claim, then I was at first a model citizen. I set to work drinking up Barlett's 100 acres, and even at pennies on the dollar it took 2 years. When I wasn't drinking, I visited the places Henry had been during the last months of his life. The grocery and gasoline station in Limbiska with the blue bonnet girl on the roof, by then closed, with a sign on the boarded-up door reading for sale by bank. The pawn shop on Dodge Street, where I emulated my son and bought the pistol, now in my jacket pocket. The Omaha branch of the First Agricultural. The pretty young teller still worked there, although her last name was no longer Penmark. "When I passed him the money, he said thank you," she told me. "Maybe he went wrong, but somebody raised him right. Did you know him?" "No," I said, "but I knew his family." Of course I went to St. Eusebia's, but made no attempt to go in and inquire about Shannon Cottery to the governess or matron or whatever her title may have been. It was a cold and forbidding hulk of a building, its thick stone and slit windows expressing perfectly how the papist hierarchy seems to feel in their hearts about women. Watching the few pregnant girls who slunk out with downcast eyes and hunched shoulders told me everything I needed to know about why Shannon had been so willing to leave it. Oddly enough, I felt closest to my son in an alley. It was the one next to the Gallatin Street drugstore and soda fountain. Schraft's candy and best homemade fudge, our specialty. 2 blocks from St. Eusebia's. There was a crate there, probably too new to be the one Henry sat on while waiting for a girl adventurous enough to trade information for cigarettes, but I could pretend, and I did. Such pretense was easier when I was drunk, and most days when I turned up on Gallatin Street, I was very drunk indeed. Sometimes I pretended it was 1922 again, and it was I who was waiting for Victoria Stevenson. If she came, I would trade her a whole carton of cigarettes to take one message. When a young man who calls himself Hank turns up here asking about Shan Cottery, tell him to get lost, to take his jazz elsewhere. Tell him his father needs him, back on the farm, that maybe with 2 of them working together, they can save it. But that girl was beyond my reach. The only Victoria I met was the later version, the one with the 3 comely children and the respectable title of Mrs. Hallett. I had stopped drinking by then. I had a job at the Built Right clothing factory and had reacquainted myself with razor blade and shaving soap. Given this veneer of respectability, she received me willingly enough. I told her who I was only because, if I am to be honest to the end, lying was not an option. I could see in the slight widening of her eyes that she had noted the resemblance. "Gee, but he was sweet," she said, "and so crazy in love. I'm sorry for Shan, too. She was a great gal. It's like a tragedy out of Shakespeare, isn't it?" Only she said it, "tragedy," and after that I didn't go back to the Gallatin Street alley anymore, because for me, Arlette's murder had poisoned even this blameless young Omaha matron's attempt at kindness. She thought Henry and Shannon's deaths were like a tragedy out of Shakespeare. She thought it was romantic. Would she still have thought so, I wonder, if she had heard my wife screaming her last from inside a blood-sodden burlap sack, or glimpsed my son's eyeless, lipless face? I held two jobs during my years in the Gateway City, also known as the City of Fools. You will say, of course, I held jobs. I would have been living on the street otherwise. But men more honest than I have continued drinking even when they want to stop, and men more decent than I have ended up sleeping in doorways. I suppose I could say that after my lost years, I made one more effort to live an actual life. There were times when I actually believed that, but lying in bed at night and listening to the rats scampering in the walls, they have been my constant companions. I always knew the truth. I was still trying to win. Even after Henry's and Shannon's deaths, even after losing the farm, I was trying to beat the corpse in the well. She and her minions. John Hanrahan was the storage foreman at the Built Right factory. He didn't want to hire a man with only one hand, but I begged for a trial. And when I proved to him that I could pull a pallet fully loaded with shirts or overalls as well as any man on his payroll, he took me on. I hauled those pallets for 14 months and often limped back to the boarding house where I was staying, with my back and stump on fire. But I never complained, and I even found time to learn sewing. This I did on my lunch hour, which was actually 15 minutes long, and during my afternoon break. While the other men were out back on the loading dock smoking and telling dirty jokes, I was teaching myself to sew seams, first in the burlap shipping bags we used, and then in the overalls that were the company's main stock and trade. I turned out to have a knack for it. I could even lay in a zipper, which is no mean skill on a garment assembly line. I'd press my stump on the garment to hold it in place as my foot ran the electric treadle. Sewing paid better than hauling, and it was easier on my back. But the sewing floor was dark and cavernous, and after 4 months or so, I began to see rats on the mountains of freshly blued denim and hunkering in the shadows beneath the hand trucks that first brought in the piecework and then rolled it out again. On several occasions, I called the attention of my co-workers to these vermin. They claimed not to see them. Perhaps they really did not. I think it far more likely that they were afraid the sewing floor might be temporarily closed down so the rat catchers could come in and do their work. The sewing crew might have lost 3 days' wages, or even a week. For men and women with families, that would have been catastrophic. It was easier for them to tell Mr. Hanrahan that I was seeing things. I understood. And when they began to call me Crazy Wilf, I understood that too. It wasn't why I quit. I quit because the rats kept moving in. I had been putting a little money away and was prepared to live on it while I looked for another job, but I didn't have to. Only 3 days after leaving Built Right, I saw an ad in the paper for a librarian at the Omaha Public Library. Must have references or a degree. I had no degree, but I have been a reader my whole life, and if the events of 1922 taught me anything, it was how to deceive. I forged references from public libraries in Kansas City and Springfield, Missouri, and got the job. I felt sure Mr. Quarles would check the references and discover they were false, so I worked at becoming the best librarian in America, and I worked fast. When my new boss confronted me with my deception, I would simply throw myself on his mercy and hope for the best. But there was no confrontation. I held my job at the Omaha Public Library for 4 years. Technically speaking, I suppose I still hold it now, although I haven't been there in a week. and have not phoned in sick. The rats, you see. They found me there, too. I began to see them crouched on piles of old books in the binding room, or scuttering along the highest shelves in the stacks, peering down at me, knowingly. Last week, in the reference room, I pulled out a volume of the Encyclopedia Britannica for an elderly patron. It was R.A. through S.T., which no doubt contains an entry for Rattus Norvegicus, not to mention Slaughterhouse, and saw a hungry gray-black face staring out at me from the vacant slot. It was the rat that bit off poor Achilloas's teat. I don't know how that could be. I'm sure I killed it, but there was no doubt. I recognized it. How could I not? There was a scrap of burlap, blood-stained burlap caught in its whiskers. Snood. I brought the volume of Britannica to the old lady who had requested it. She wore an ermine stole, and the thing's little black eyes regarded me bleakly. Then I simply walked out. I wandered the streets for hours and eventually came here, to the Magnolia Hotel. And here I have been ever since, spending the money I have saved as a librarian, which doesn't matter any longer, and writing my confession, which does. One of them just nipped me on the ankle, as if to say, get on with it, time's almost up. A little blood has begun to stain my sock. It doesn't disturb me, not in the slightest. I've seen more blood in my time. In 1922, there was a room filled with it. And now I think I hear... Is it my imagination? Nope. Someone has come visiting. I plugged the pipe, but the rat still escaped. I filled in the well, but she also found her way out, and this time I don't think she's alone. I think I hear two sets of shuffling feet, not just one. Or three? Is it three? Is the girl who would have been my daughter-in-law in a better world with them as well? I think she is. Three corpses shuffling up the hall. Their faces, what remains of them, disfigured by rat bites. Arlette's cocked to one side as well, by the kick of a dying cow. Another bite on the ankle. And another. How the management would... Gow! Another. But they won't have me. And my visitors won't either, although now I can see the doorknob turning and I can smell them. The remaining flesh hanging on their bones, giving off the stench of slaughtered... The gun! God, where's the... Stop! Ah! Make them stop biting me!
From the Omaha World Herald, April 14th, 1930. Librarian commits suicide in local hotel. Bizarre scene greets hotel security man. The body of Wilfred James, a librarian at the Omaha Public Library, was found in a local hotel on Sunday when efforts by hotel staff to contact him met with no response. The resident of a nearby room had complained of a smell like bad meat, and a hotel chambermaid reported hearing muffled shouting or crying like a man in pain late Friday afternoon. After knocking repeatedly and receiving no response, the hotel's chief of security used his passkey and discovered the body of Mr. James, slumped over the room's writing desk. "I saw a pistol and assumed he had shot himself," the security man said. "But no one had reported a gunshot, and there was no smell of expended powder. When I checked the gun, I determined it was a badly maintained 25 and not loaded. By then, of course, I had seen the blood. I have never seen anything like that before, and never want to again. He had bitten himself all over. Arms, legs, ankles, even his toes. Nor was that all. It was clear he had been busy with some sort of writing project, but he had chewed up the paper as well. It was all over the floor. It looked like paper does when rats chew it up to make their nests. In the end, he chewed his own wrists open, I believe that's what killed him. He certainly must have been deranged. Little is known of Mr. James at this writing. Ronald Quarles, the head librarian at the Omaha Public Library, took Mr. James on in late 1926. He was obviously down on his luck and handicapped by the loss of a hand, but he knew his books and his references were good, Quarles said. He was collegial, but distant. I believe he had been doing factory work before applying for a position here, and he told people that before losing his hand, he had owned a small farm in Hemingford County. The World Herald is interested in the unfortunate Mr. James, and solicits information from any readers who may have known him. The body is being held at the Omaha County Morgue pending disposition by next of kin. If no next of kin appears, said Dr. Tattersall, the morgue's chief medical officer, I suppose he will be buried in public ground.
"1922" was written by Stephen King and read by Craig Wasson. It was recorded at the Mix House in Boise, Idaho, by David Getter. Editing and post-production by Hudson Sound. The associate producer was Michael Noble. "1922" was produced and directed by Karen Perlman. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. "1922" is available as an ebook from Scribner. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio. It, a Novel, by Stephen King. Read by Stephen Weber. And Sleeping Beauties, a Novel, by Stephen King and Owen King. Read by Marin Ireland.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.